Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, arts and culture organizations are reeling after the governor vetoes all of their state funding. We talk to the local creative community about what happens now. Later in the program, a new film tracks the life and legacy of artist, educator, and First Coast native Augusta Savage. But first, Governor Ron DeSantis' surprise veto of all state funding for arts and culture organizations stunned Florida's creative community, including here on the First Coast. Here to talk about the impact and the road ahead, I'm joined by Bethany Pellini, Managing Artistic Director at the Five and Dime Theater Company. Good morning, Bethany.
Good morning.
I am also joined by Kathy Wallace, Executive Director of the Beaches Fine Arts Series. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here. Amy Palmer, Program Director at the Community Foundation. Hey, Amy.
Hey, good morning.
And Sherry Province, Executive Director of the Limelight Theater in St. Augustine.
Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. We're also joined on the line by Diana Donovan, Executive Director of the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. Good morning, Diana.
Good morning.
So, Sherry, let's just start, if we can, with your reaction. How did you learn about these cuts, and what was your initial response?
Well, we were told, at first, it was a rumor. And then when it was handed down, we just received it from our cultural council that these cuts were going to be made. And then we were asked to get our minds right to go to the county and begin asking for a little extra funding there and start to make preparations because they knew that it was going to affect us dramatically.
And you're in St. Augustine, so the county for you is St. John's County. Has that ask begun?
Oh, yes. In fact, a couple of Mondays ago, we were in front of the Tourism Development Council. We receive quite a bit of money from them on a yearly basis for operations. And we were there asking to see if there was any other funds that they could allocate for us. And all the executive directors from the arts organizations in the county were there petitioning for extra money.
So some community support that is being, displayed, that's in evidence.
Yes. But I think everybody's aware that we are reeling and not really prepared. Many organizations, they depend solely on these grants to operate. And, grants make up a third of our budget, and it will dramatically affect our bottom line this year, what we are allowed to do, our programming. And it goes so much beyond programming for us in the arts. It's about the people that it affects.
We've got a brief break that we're going to take. We're just having a little technical difficulty. We're going to take a break and be back in just a minute. Sorry about that, folks. We're back. I want to ask you, Kathy, of Beaches Fine Arts Series, some support in the community. But this is clearly kind of unprecedented, isn't it? This cutting of all state funding for arts and culture.
Yes, I believe it's the first time that the state of Florida has ever zeroed out arts and culture.
And so what was your response?
I was shocked, like everyone else. And we're still reeling from that and trying to figure out what we're going to do next. As a free concert series, we bring in artists from all over the world, and we do award-winning educational outreach programs for the community. And so we're looking at what we can do. We don't want to eliminate anything. So.
And you have strong support from lawmakers and legislators in this state. Is that true?
Well, in particular, we had Representative Aaron Bean, who was one of our stars for our major fundraiser, First Coast Dancing with the Stars. And then he was an MC the year after that because he really liked it so much. And I've been in touch with him. He doesn't have the ability to really say or do anything, but it was great that he responded to me. And I'm kind of starting a conversation with Clay Yarborough,
right,
who's senator, Florida senator.
State senator. So, yeah. Diana Donovan, for people who don't know how arts funding works, how important is this state money to these organizations? And we should say Cultural Council also took a hit.
Absolutely. So we are one of the grant recipients, but I would say for the entire sector, as the leading local arts agency for Duval County, when we quantify the economic impact of what this hit means, you know, the total funding request for the three categories of grants for statewide funding was $2.6 million. When we look at that $2.6 million and we look at our cultural service grantees, which are the organizations that we helped fund through the City of Jacksonville funding, 23 of those organizations were affected out of 30, 23 out of 30 grants applications. That's $2 million of that $2.6 million of the fully funded impact request being zeroed out. And the challenge with that is, you know, if I'm a listener, I'm wondering, like, how does this actually impact me? How does this impact my quality of life in my home and my city? When we think about the fact that all of the cultural service grantees that we serve, which is approximately 30 different grantees, their economic impact in the city of Jacksonville alone is $114 million. Out of that $114 million of economic impact, $105 million is focused in the downtown arena. We are having a lot of conversations right now about the revitalization, activating, and optimization of downtown. We are also coming out of a pandemic recovery. The Cultural Council had the same funding just a few years ago that did 20 years ago, with ups and downs in between. So we've come back into this new space from a city funding area where we're catching up. And to have the state, you know, have these grants zeroed out, the challenge is that what does the downstream effect look like for quality of life? Arts and culture is good business, will always be good business. Mm. When you're downtown or in the general Duval area, because we also serve the nonprofits and the beaches, you're going to have less experiences, less revenue. When we say less revenue, what does that mean? That means if you're a bartender, you're getting less tips, you're getting less patrons. If you're working in a parking garage, you're getting less parking. Ubers, restaurants, all those places that are activated when we have one night at the Florida Theater open, one night at Mocha open, one night at Mosh open, one night at the Comer open. You know, these are some of our biggest economic drivers located downtown, taking slashes and cuts in real time. And some of them being able to get funding and other revenue sources is just not enough to perpetuate what is needed to activate this, you know, capital infrastructure and operational quality of life that they need to sustain these good experiences. When we look at America for the Arts, Cultural Council stood in the gap and did a Northeast Regional Economic Impact Study for our entire region. When we look at people coming into Jacksonville, we look at people coming into the city, 87% of non-local attendees reported that their primary purpose for their visit was for a cultural performance, event, exhibit, venue, or facility.
So clearly a lot of economic impact from the arts. I want to bring Amy into the conversation. You are currently with the Community Foundation, but for many years you were the Director of Grants Administration at the Cultural Council.
That's right.
Explain what this sudden deletion of money doesn't maybe account for in terms of the money that these groups are expecting and counting on, and kind of how they budget that money that would have started flowing July 1.
Right. That's right. It does represent an immediate cut for these organizations because the state's fiscal year begins July 1. It is a long process. As a matter of fact, the applications for fiscal year 26 were just due June 3rd. So the process for next year's funding has already begun. And so, there's the application process, there is peer review panels and scoring. So it's really a rather long process, but one that the arts and cultural organizations are very familiar with. These grant programs, there are actually four, but we're talking about one that provides general program support for these organizations. It is something that really has been funded almost every year for decades, except for this year.
So, yeah, is there an explanation as to why this money was deleted wholesale?
We really do not know. It was part of, I believe, $950 million worth of vetoes. And the only indication really is that, the governor's stated goal was to have a smaller budget than the year prior. And then, $32 million worth of arts grants.
Yeah, but all part of arts this. Funding, all cultural funding in that budget.
Well, yes, in terms of grant programs through the Florida Department of State Division of Arts and Culture. There were some projects that are referred to as member projects, members of the legislature that were for arts and cultural projects that did make it past the veto pen. So we do have some projects, but they were outside of this regular application process. And I did want to mention, too, that in terms of what this means for the organizations, the general program support is so important because it's for those unsexy things. A lot of funders like to have projects, really exciting, innovative things happen. But this general program support from the state of Florida, it helped provide staff salaries, office supplies, all those types of things. And it helped to leverage dollars to match other grants, such as the Cultural Council Cultural Service Grant that's funded by the city of Jacksonville.
Bethany, for Five and Dime Theater, first of all, tell us a little bit about how this funding impacts you and what it's going to mean for your staff or your season.
Sure. So these cuts take away 58% of our funded income and 12% of our projected income. So that's quite a lot. Right now, what we're going to do is focus on community support more than ever. Getting those ticket sales out there, getting people to come support us, give donations. And then we're going to look at doing our own budget cuts. Unfortunately, that may mean scaling back on the quality of our productions and in the technical aspect, right? Not necessarily the quality, but I guess the quantity more so. Pulling back a little bit on the costumes, the set pieces, things like that. But also something that we might have to face is maybe cutting back down on our season, unfortunately. It's not what we want to do, but it's something we might have to do in order to survive.
What are you hearing from your clients, your fans, the people that come to Five and Dime?
Well, it's still kind of this like fresh news that, like Sherry said, started out as a rumor and is now reality that we're facing. And folks are concerned. They are concerned for everybody involved in the arts, for our culture. But at the same time, we are artists and we're going to do what we do best. And that is to move forward. The show will go on.
That's right.
Not just must, but it will. And it always does.
Yeah. Right. And Sherry, how is the art? I mean, there's all kinds of groups that were cut, some large, some small. How is the community coming together, or what do these discussions look like within the cultural community from these impacted groups?
Well, I think right now we don't have an actual plan of action. It's true that we were moving forward assuming that, I guess it's shocking in the sense that we thought we might even be getting a little bit more money this year.
Yeah.
And we were so excited that we thought maybe even more money was coming our way. And so It has set us back, and we are also looking at, I've already cut one of the shows out of our season. So, and we do offer a very robust season. So we have room to cut, and I'm very grateful for that. But we have a small staff, and I think what we tend to focus on more is, you know, we will always move forward with programming because we have our own building and we have a place where we can continue to meet and produce theater. And we're very fortunate. But the people that are affected by this, the staff, we might, you know, who knows if we will be able to sustain salaries. I know that the ripple, we have not seen the magnitude yet because we haven't even begun to live the cuts.
Right.
The budget cuts. So I'm a little nervous. And I think this is a time where we all are just thinking, surely there are generous people out there that know the importance of the arts because they themselves have been affected and changed by good storytelling or impactful music or an incredible film. This is the time to really rally and help support the artists and the organizations that need help, even if it's through private donorship, to sustain our programming. And the programs matter because it's the people inside the programs that their lives are so impacted and changed. I mean, we really, in theater specifically, say that the performing arts saves people's lives.
It saved mine.
Yeah,
I'll tell you that.
Gives them a sense of belonging and
right.
connection and a reason for a purpose. It's not just entertainment and not even just a source of expression, even though it's all those things, but it is a sense of community and the coming together that will be lost if we don't maintain some type of funding.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the zeroing out of the arts and culture budgets, recent vetoes by Governor Ron DeSantis, and how our local organizations are reacting. You can join our conversation by calling us on air at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or tag us on social media. Kathy, this is a shock for the local community. We're talking to a number of organizations here today, of course, but we should note some that have been cut include Symphony, MoCA, Jacksonville, the Kummer Museum, Theater Jacksonville, the Leitner Museum, the St. Augustine Lighthouse, the Cathedral Arts Project, so many, many organizations. But I have a question for you because this is a political discussion on some level, and I don't think a lot of artists want to be involved in those political discussions necessarily, but I will say in planning for this segment, there were a lot of people that we reached out to that didn't want to participate, that very much wanted this segment to happen, but didn't necessarily want to weigh in.
True. That's what I've heard. And I'm disappointed in that. I think that the larger organizations, it would be great if they were participating out here today. But I know there's a lot of fear out there. We're a small organization. We have 2.5 employees, and the half is very important to us. And we do not plan to cut our employees. We don't plan to cut our programming, but we do plan to reach out to the community to ask for some way that they have of supporting us during this time. Right now, ironically, we just sent out our annual ask to our patrons, and it went out with our new schedule, which is not the one you see here, but a sort of nice schedule, and it has the Florida Division of Arts and Culture on the schedule because it was printed before we knew this, which is ironic. But we're just hoping that the community will step up for all of us, right? Mm-hmm. And support us during this time. And I'm concerned also, frankly, Anne, about the future and what will happen next year since we just turned in those grants. As Amy was saying, that those just went in the beginning of June, and then they're supposed to be hearings for those probably in July, I would guess. And
yeah, later this summer.
Yeah. And we haven't heard a thing from the Division of Arts and Culture because I'm sure they're trying to figure out what they're going to do as well.
We have a call from Josh in Miramar. Good morning, Josh. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. First, I wanted to empathize, tell you I'm sorry, because it's great when I get to go down with my whole family to a free concert down by the shipyards and hear Andy Grammer play, and then just countless other things that you've mentioned that are going to be gone. A couple ideas. One, after this next election cycle, if the results go as I think they will, what about like a GoFundMe? I just think it's amazing when the community does come together to kind of make up some of the shortfall. And I'd love to be a part of that. You know, just say, hey, this is what happened. Remind people what happened and see if we can just come together and make that up through a fundraising, community fundraising. And then I guess before I sign off, Clay Yarbrough and Aaron Bean, I would say they're complicit. I do believe that. And so when you guys say that we contacted Aaron Bean and he's so nice, I would push back on that. And I'm going to say it's not surprising that either of them haven't been helpful. But in a positive note, I would say continue to work with them because they're in that regime. They're in the Ron DeSantis regime. And so they can push back way more than we can and say, hey, is there a way to, you know, undo this? Is there a way to keep working on this? Because a one and done with them, that's what they're looking for.
Josh,
they gave their kind lip service. And all right. That's
thank
it.
You. Thanks so much. I want to take a call from Jerry in St. Augustine. Good morning, Jerry. Go ahead.
Good morning. Yes. I just wanted to express my opposition to this cut. I've been in the arts my entire life as a performer, as a professor, as an after school teacher. And it's just unbelievable that a Harvard and Yale educated politician would not recognize the economic and enrichment contributions to society by the arts. Children without resources will not get the arts lessons. They'll go without. Artists will not have jobs anymore. Arts organizations will have less resources to look for those extra funds that they have to now. Artists usually enliven city areas that are often underserved, and community gatherings will be lessened. I just feel that this is such a stingy and short-sighted decision. It's just heartbreaking.
Thanks, Jerry. Appreciate your input. I want to bring Diana Donovan back into the conversation. Oh, perhaps she, I'm not sure if we've got her there or not. I want to ask you, Bethany, because you sort of alluded to it, and I think a lot of people who in the arts feel this, that it is a life-changing experience. It really does impact people on a personal level. What can you tell us about your own experience?
Well, I've been on theater, on the stage, I should say, since I was a newborn in a play at a church. So I've been on stage and involved in the theater as you know, my whole life. And so it is such an outlet. It is such an outlet. Mm-hmm. The world that we live in, being a human is just hard. And we all need something, right? And this was my something. And whether it's music, whether it's writing, whether it's crafting, creating, everyone needs it. It's good for mental health, but it's also the education behind it. I'm a former educator as well in the public schools for theater. And I've seen firsthand how this can save an adolescent's life, how this was the one thing that kept them going to school. This was the one thing that kept them from staying home. This was the one thing that made the friends that they have forever. And just like any sport, yeah, it provides the same exact team building resources. Those folks, those kids who are involved in the arts at all, proved to be some of the most successful in their career, the career development alone.
We have a board member who's says that the education program at the Limelight Theater saved her son's life.
Yes.
He was dealing with adolescent depression. And it didn't just give him confidence, but it gave him purpose. And now he is in an art school. He's a senior. He's been the star of two of our productions. He's starring in the shows that his high school is producing, and he's pursuing this as a career. And so it's just story after story that we've also encountered like that. And so much so, and something that Donna said made me think of this too, about the mental health that you just mentioned. It really is about the mental health of our community, the arts and culture that feeds that. But the mental health of our community really contributes to the economic, physical health of our state. Because when you've got people that feel good and they're connected and feeling powerful, like powerful human beings, they want to go to work. They want to be a contributing member of society. And I think it's just we are all so connected, and it is one big circle. If you cut one thing, it really does affect so many other things. This is going to be big. It's really going to be a big ripple.
Amy, it's obviously people, you know, feel strongly about it, and perhaps has these kind of unquantifiable, even economic impacts on people's lives. What would you advise people to do at this point? I mean, given your knowledge of how this whole grants process works.
Well, I think there are two points. One is it's important to note that there is strong bipartisan support in the legislature for these grants programs. As a matter of fact, it was the legislators who, put funding back into the budget this year, and then it was vetoed. So that when everyone says they were expecting funding, it was because it was in the budget that was
allocated by lawmakers.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. So I think continuing to communicate with your lawmakers, mm-hmm. For organizations out there who've been affected, you know, make sure that you're inviting your elected officials to your events. They're on your, newsletter distribution lists so that they understand the good work that you're doing and how important it is. I mean, not only from a personal basis, but in terms of economic return on investment, attracting tourists, attracting businesses, retaining workers, if for our quality of life, educational outcomes. It just goes on and on what the arts can do for our community and why it is a strong investment for the state of Florida. Also, just in terms of individual charitable contributions, all of us can be philanthropists. It doesn't matter how much we give. And so if you're listening and you want to help these organizations, this is a great time to make a donation, an additional donation, a stretch gift to try to help provide stopgap funding, because as we mentioned, these are immediate cuts. They're going to have to make this up, or it will have real impacts. And then also for organizations who've been affected, please be sure that you're communicating with your donors. You have relationships with them. Let them know what's happening and how they can help.
I just want to take one brief call. Diana at the beach, or Diane at the beach, could you just briefly go ahead?
Hey, this is Diana Donovan from the Cultural Council, and just wanted to share and echo and underscore the critical component of this being public and private partnership. The city works well when it's in partnership with the state. The private sector works well when it's in partnership with the public sector. The private sector, not only are we activating and asking our donors to contribute and to attend and to be patrons and participate in the arts and experiences that we have now happening, but also looking at our business leaders in the private sector to step in and say, this is our priority. Mayor Deegan has stepped in and said it's her priority. City Council, voted locally last year to help make sure that we had this quality of life so we could have arts and good business, economic returns, and the souls impacted through this. Our local Duval County cultural service grantees serve close to 400,000 children in just our city. So, you know, there are real lives being impacted by this, and there is a real bottom line that's enhanced. And when you think about that in the future of, you know, mental health and arts and culture and healing and what that means for us as a city and society, you know, it's essential to quality of life. And there's a lot of quality of life conversations happening right now in city funding.
Right. Well, so, Diana Donovan, thank you so much for being here. Kathy Wallace, Bethany Pollini, Amy Palmer, and Sherry Province, appreciate all of you being here, and we'll look to hear from you as this moves on.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, exploring the life of visionary artist and Northeast Florida native Augusta Savage. Welcome back. One of the most influential artists of the 20th century hailed from Green Cove Springs. The life and legacy of Augusta Savage is the subject of a new documentary, which premieres at WJCT Studios this Saturday. To talk about it, we're joined by art historian and curator Dr. Jeffreen Hayes, the film's narrator.
I don't think we have time. No.
Good morning, Dr. Hayes. I think you're on air. Can you join us? We're also going to welcome filmmakers Sandy Ratley and Charlotte Mangan, creators of the new documentary, Searching for Augusta Savage. Good morning.
Good morning, Anne.
Good morning. So this film starts at the 1939 World Fair. Dr. Hayes, why was that event a breakout moment for the artist Augusta Savage?
Good morning. Augusta Savage was one of several women who were invited to be part of the World's Fair, and she was the only Black woman. And with her commission, Lift Every Voice and Sing, it was a homage to the hymn, Lift Every Voice and Sing, as well as a homage to her friend, James Weldon Johnson. And it was an important moment for her because it was the largest sculpture that she had made to date, and it had a very prominent place in the fair. It was one of the most popular works of art, and it was the most photographed. And so it set her apart and really kind of took her in terms of an artist to the next level.
And this was this piece that, you know, as you said, was an homage to the James Weldon Johnson. He wrote the song Lift Every Voice and Sing. And this is kind of this massive sculpture with, you know, a bunch of, I guess, 12 vocalists sort of standing in a harp-like position behind another gentleman who's kind of lifting an instrument. And it was, as you say, very popular at the World's Fair, photographed. There were souvenirs made of it. And then sadly, it was destroyed.
Yes, it was destroyed. And one of the things that was a practice of the World's Fair was to destroy the things that were made. So the sculpture was not intended to be permanent, but there was a campaign to try and save it. And either cast it in bronze or to store it, because it was such an important piece for Augusta Savage, as well as, you know, the Black community in terms of representation. And
okay. Sandy, as one of the film's creators, you've titled it Searching for Augusta Savage. Explain what the destruction of her artwork and kind of her other artwork through her life, how that plays into the title, or how that inspired the title of the film.
The title of the film, we decided on that because we felt as if we were searching for answers about Augusta Savage's life. She was very prolific in her art practice, creating 160 or more sculptures, but half of those works of art have either been lost or destroyed. There was some uncertainty about why she left New York and moved upstate to Socrates, New York, where she spent the last 20 years of her life. So part of the search was to really find answers in terms of considering a woman who was so accomplished, who established a model for the nation for community arts with the Harlem Community Arts Center, that was visited by First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt and was established as a model for how art should be taught at a community level. That she mentored and taught so many really well-known African-American artists who really helped to establish the art canon of the 20th century, that we were looking to find out what are the factors, what were the societal factors, what were the financial factors, what were the factors that may have been related to her as a Black woman that really seemed to tap down the acknowledgement that she deserves for all that she accomplished. Of course, many scholars like Dr. Hayes and others have been studying and have been inspired by Augusta Savage, but we were feeling as if the general public needed to have a greater understanding of the extent to which she has really helped to build the landscape for much of the art that we appreciate and love today.
And Charlotte, we said she's from Green Cove Springs. She actually grew up, you know, kind of making little figures out of the red clay of Green Cove Springs, had a lot of trouble doing that. You learned, you know, her childhood was difficult. Her father did not support her art initiative or kind of her interest in the arts. But then she moved and became a central figure of the Harlem Renaissance. Tell us a little bit about her transformation into that world from being in Green Cove Springs to being invited, winning a scholarship to a very prestigious art school in Paris.
Absolutely. Hi, thank you for having us. So in 1919, she actually participated in the West Palm Beach County Fair and won a prize and was able to take up a donation from fans of her work. And that allowed her to go to Jacksonville, where she tried to make money creating busts of prominent wealthy Black residents. But then, unfortunately, that didn't work out. And she ended up being encouraged to move up to New York, potentially in part by the friendship that she made in Jacksonville with James Weldon Johnson, who is a poet and wrote Lift Every Voice and Sing, would become a lifelong friend. And as Dr. Hayes mentioned, the inspiration for her 1939 World's Fair sculpture. And so she moved up to Harlem as part of the Harlem Renaissance, as she puts it, arriving with $4.50 in the pocket of her homemade coat, and was introduced to the director of Cooper Union, which is an art college that continues to offer free arts education for students. And by virtue of her beautiful work, she was able to get ahead of a line of, I think, 75 other applicants, and was offered a scholarship and completed her studies there in 3 years instead of four. All the while working as a caretaker and laundry, working in laundry as did many Black women of the time. So Cooper Union sort of was, you know, she had been self-taught until then, and Cooper Union launched her career, and she went on to receive fellowships to study in France and other parts of Europe.
But that scholarship that she was offered, I mean, it ended up being rescinded. Is that true? Because she was a Black woman.
I'm so sorry. I couldn't understand you. It's very scratchy.
Oh, I apologize. I'll try to ask again. But I believe that offer of a scholarship to the Fontainebleau School of the Arts in Paris was rescinded because she was a Black woman. And there was a discussion as to whether she would feel uncomfortable sharing accommodations with white women.
Actually, it wasn't about her comfort. That there were two schoolmates of hers from Cooper Union who were from the South, and they were the ones who basically protested having to travel and or be in accommodations with Augusta, and that was why the scholarship was rescinded.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply that that was the case, just that that was what was expressed. But yes, okay. So she was not allowed to take advantage of that scholarship. But she went on to create this Black art gallery, the first of its kind in the country, and very influential with a whole future generation of Black artists. Dr. Hayes.
Yes. Yes. So she did create the Salon of Contemporary Negro Art, which was the first Black commercial art gallery for Black artists, and she really felt that it was important for Black artists to have a space to not just show their work, but to also sell their work. Savage was someone who spoke very publicly about the fact that Black artists' work were not being collected at the same rate as their white peers, and so she had the foresight to go ahead and incorporate this, the gallery, and use $10,000 to start it. Unfortunately, given the timing of the opening of the gallery, you know, we're talking about the Great Depression era, the gallery only lasted about 3 months. And while that is the case, it is an important institution that she built, given where we are today and in art. The issue around Black artists needing representation, wanting to share their work, having the work accessible to not just private collectors, but also public institutions. A lot of times the commercial galleries are that space. And so she really laid a foundation for future galleries, and also really thinking ahead in terms of what kinds of institutions, whether it's a gallery, whether it's a museum or an art space, or even an educational space, what kinds of spaces can we create to support artists who are underrepresented?
Well, her legacy is definitely carried on and furthered by this film, Searching for Augusta Savage. It premieres June 29th at the WJCT Soundstage at 2 o'clock, and it's going to be followed by a reception at the Yellow House at 4 o'clock. Dr. Jeffrine Hayes, Sandy Ratley, Charlotte Mangan, thank you so much for being here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us and allowing us this opportunity to really let people know about Augusta Savage and the film that will be shown on Saturday. Thank you.
Thank you. Our pleasure. Up next, we explore supernovas, crab nebulas, and a strawberry moon with our resident spaceman.
Thank you. Florida Early Learning Corps is seeking tutors for the 2024-25 school year to help Florida's youngest learners prepare for kindergarten. AmeriCorps tutors are dedicated to providing extra practice and personalized support. More info at join.readingandmath.org. LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
China's manufacturing muscle-made apple, a global phenomenon.
One of the biggest Apple factories was producing 500,000 iPhones a day.
But the company's relationship with China has not been easy.
Tim Cook was turning up in Beijing more often and with glumer looks on his face than in the past.
Apple, China, and who controls tech, next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Scott Tong. Thinking of going off-grid? You better be handy. This guy had an epic fail with a solar-charged battery system.
You really, really shouldn't try to run a full-size vacuum cleaner off of that because you smoke will result.
Our climate series Reverse Course continues next time in Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
Grief is an experience we all face, but humans aren't the only species that mourn the loss of a loved one. Orcas carry their deceased children on their backs, and birds flock around the body of one of their own to pay their respects. We talk about how animals grieve. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, there's a lot to look up for this summer, including a potential once-in-a-lifetime astronomical event. And join me to discuss it as our resident spaceman, Eddie Whistler.
Ah.
He's the planetarium director at the Museum of Science and History. Welcome back, Eddie.
Hey, it's always fun.
It is always fun. So July 4th is just around the corner.
Yeah.
That date has some significance beyond our own nation's birthday celebration.
Yeah, apparently there were universe fireworks.
At a time.
Yeah.
Long ago. Tell us about this. This is in the year 1054.
All right. And depending, so there have been a lot of changes that have been made to calendars. But if you follow the modern calendar back, then on the 4th of July, humans looked up and saw a guest star. That's how ancient Chinese astronomers described it. Because it was a star that just... Now, it wasn't any old star. It just arrived like a guest, you know, on your door.
Hello.
Unexpected. Okay, we're going to stay with you for a couple of months. Oh, okay, welcome. That's the star. It kind of showed up. This was at a time when people, you know, 1054, we understand stars, we see them, but we don't really understand what stars are. We have to wait several hundred years before we really wrap our minds around what's going on. And then one flared up. It was easily visible during the daytime. You could read by it at night.
Wow.
So it's this kind of brightness. And everybody around the world would have seen it. Many different people documented it in different ways. And if that documentation survived to the modern day, then we look up with our modern telescopes and we see the remnant of a star that blew itself up, and it's called the Crab Nebula. Everybody should rush to their computers and look up Crab Nebula. And then a lot of people might be like, oh, I've seen that image. Actually, it's this beautiful image in space.
So this star blew up?
Yes, it was a supernova explosion. And in the heart is a remnant. It's the core of the collapsed star that blew itself up.
It still exists?
It still exists. This is what happens when you... I'm going to play just from my phone into the microphone the remnant that we listen in on. So we're going to take some We're going to take some waves of light and we're going to bring them into the human audio range just so that you can get a sense for what's at the center. Check this out.
All right.
That's the core of an exploded star spinning in space 30 times a second.
Wow, that's crazy.
That's what gets left over. Now, the density of this leftover remnant core of a star, if you had a teaspoon full of it, it would, let's say, be the mass of something like a Mount Everest, all packed into a teaspoon, because it's crushed to just about the breaking point of physics.
That's
and that
amazing.
Thing is spinning that fast at the center of the Crab Nebula. Check it out.
So Google the Crab Nebula.
Yeah, it's like a, you know, a firework explodes and there's the smoke that's in the air after that firework. Well, this is the dust and gas that's blown out from 1054.
What is the difference between a nova and a supernova?
A supernova is like an easy way to categorize it, just for the listeners in 2 seconds, is it's a catastrophic ending to a star. And a nova is like, is a buildup of material. I see where you're going with this, and I don't know if we have enough time to get into it, but there's going to be a new star in the nighttime sky that we'll be able to, and it's all over the place. T. Corona Borealis is the name of it. But this is a regular flare-up, and when it flares up, we'll see it as a star in the nighttime sky. But this is not read by it at night, see it during the day type stuff. This is one more point of light in the sky full of points of light. Only if you become familiar with the part of the nighttime sky where it will be, and we know it will be there because we're good like that, then you'll see tonight it's not there. And then when you hear all of the updates coming in, that, oh, it's erupting, go ahead, look out. This eruption is taking place enormously far away, but we'll see it as just like a point of light in the nighttime sky. And then you're familiar with that part of the nighttime sky. You look up and you're like, oh, yeah, that wasn't there the day before.
And it'll come and then disappear again?
Yeah, it'll fade out. We know this because we've recorded it happening at a regular interval, about every 80 years. So
I just briefly want to ask, we had a strawberry moon recently. What is the deal with all the named moons? I didn't feel like we used to name the moons as much as, or talk about them as much.
So we get 12 full moons every year. And then about every 32 months, we get a second full moon in a month. That's what we call a blue moon.
Mm-hmm.
But we just named them. The moon that takes place, you referenced the rose moon, is when Europeans used to harvest roses at that particular moon in the year.
What's the deal with the strawberry?
Oh, strawberry moon. Okay, so strawberry moon, we're going to harvest strawberries. Wolf moon is when the wolves build their dens. You know, like we humans name these things, and different civilizations named the 12 moons differently according to what was important to them.
I always learn like at least one or two factoids with you, Eddie Whistler.
Oh, this was like six though, right?
Six, maybe. Maybe
yeah.
Four, six. Thank you for
four,
being here.
Four, six, eight? No.
It's great to have you back.
Love being here.
All right. Join us tomorrow when we give outgoing City Council President Ron Salem his exit interview. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.